Hi, I'm Mike Esnault, and welcome to the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge's AC23 Plus Artist Legacy Series podcast. This is a series where we talk to artists who are doing amazing things in the areas of the arts, including performance, education, production, as well as arts advocacy. We record this series in the Virginia and John Nolan Black Box Studio, as well as in the Jan and Bill Grimes Recording Studio here at the Cary Siraj Community Arts Center. Be sure to visit artsbr.org for more information on all the great things we are doing here at the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge. Hope you enjoy the podcast series, and thanks for tuning in.
All right. I would like to welcome our AC23 listeners to another session. I'm Mike Esnault, Director of Arts and Education here at the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge. And today I have a friend and amazing artist, visual artist, Mr. Mike Weary. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
Absolutely. Mike and Mike.
Mike and Mike. Mike check.
So Mike Weary is our primary artist in residence. Well, so tell the listeners, like, what you're up to. All things Mike Weary.
Oh, man. All things Mike Weary. First and foremost, I always lead with just, I'm an artist, just purely. I wake up in the morning, and the first thing I'm thinking about is, all right, what am I creating today? Mm-hmm. And when I say creating, I mean, you know, specifically visual art, painting, drawing. Am I drawing something? And after I'm drawing it, what am I painting? I work with oil paints, and I mix it with copper and iron. And that's kind of where my mind goes. And typically, I dream a lot. And so waking up is usually the first thing I'm thinking about is painting, because I'm usually creating those things in my dreams. If I'm not creating, literally painting in my dreams, I'm dreaming something wild. So I'm like, all right, I gotta get that down. So that's kind of where I start my days. And then I get up early and I work through all of those emotions, all of those different things that are coming to me. And then about mid-morning, I'm getting into the more service to the people more so. And that's kind of mm-hmm. where I am now, is just creating, and then how can I help others to do the same.
So would you say, based on that, you do kind of your most creative time, would that be in the mornings?
Yeah, it's definitely in the mornings. I find a lot of visual artists, their most creative times are typically at night. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. Mine has always been in the morning times.
Right.
I don't know if it's because I've had a lot of issues in the past with just like sleep and sleep deprivation, I guess, mm-hmm. insomnia, and longing to go to sleep, just laying there. So I never found myself creative. I found myself late at night just trying to go to sleep.
Right.
And so when I wake back up in the morning, it's just like so much of that is just weighing on me. And now it's like, I gotta create it for some reason. So yeah, the morning time for me is the most creative. I find it to be the quietest point in the day, you know, no one's really up. I mean, mm-hmm. I wake up typically around 5 in the morning and right. just kind of shimmy around town, shimmy around the studio. And it's very quiet, and that quiet helps me kind of sort through my thoughts and what I was just dreaming about, I guess. My son says his movies that he gets to watch all day.
Well, I know when I get here at the Arts Council, you've been going at it for a while.
And yeah,
that's pretty early in the morning.
Yeah, I've been doing Daddy summer camp this summer, so I've been getting here a little bit later. So I've been getting here about 8 o'clock now, but ideally, I like to get here closer to 5:30 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
And usually before that, I'm usually up about 4:30, and I'm just, I don't know, it's like my body tells me you need to get up, and you know, I'm just, again, it's just, I don't know, there's something peaceful about the morning time.
Sure.
There's something peaceful about always watching the sunrise.
Mm.
I find that's something that most people miss. We always see the sunsets, you know, everybody's there for a sunset, but the sunrise, like, you got to actually be up for that. You know,
right?
Or you feel the sunrise, maybe, you know,
mm-hmm.
coming through your window, but no one's there sitting at the horizon waiting for it to kind of just come up. And right. I find something enjoyable about that.
Well, one of the things I've always found fascinating, in getting to know you is, and I'm not a visual artist, so I don't know much at all about technique, but I do find it interesting that when you paint, it seems like the majority of the time, mm-hmm. you do your paintings upside down.
Yeah. And
that's when you're creating.
Yeah. I turn them upside down. Now, as far as technique, it's a fairly common technique to do at some point during your process. Mm-hmm. And when I say common is if you go to art school, some teachers may tell you, hey, if you're struggling with a piece, if you're not sure where you want to go with this piece, mm-hmm. maybe turn it on its side, maybe turn it upside down and you'll see something, maybe that's glaring that you didn't see right side up. But I do that process from the start to the finish. And it's for me, number one, I think I am dyslexic. A lot mm-hmm. of things kind of come in visually backwards, especially like listening. Mm-hmm. If someone tells me something, I have to kind of rearrange it most of the times to for it to make sense for me.
Right.
And also visually writing stuff. It's like writing has always been an issue mm-hmm. with like I'm left-handed. So I don't know if that has something to do with it. I don't know, but it's the input for me is always skewed. And mm-hmm. I didn't really know it was skewed until like you get into school and you're trying to learn things and you have to like learn and relearn.
Right.
And re-break things down. But in the visual arts of it all, as far as the technique, it does break down the images, I find, easier. Another technique that I would say is similar is if you're using reference or if you're looking out into nature and you're drawing a painting from nature, you're taught sometimes to squint your eyes because we're creating from how light is hitting objects, right?
Right.
That's how you create, the visual. And when you squint, it breaks down those what we call values to a more simpler version. So mm-hmm. if I squint and I'm looking at your face right now, the squinting breaks down the shinier part where the light from above is hitting your forehead to the darker part, as opposed to I can see every single nook and cranny when I'm looking at you with my eyes wide open.
You're making me very self-conscious right now, but okay, go ahead, keep going.
But so I can see all the wrinkles, man, all the wrinkles.
They're there.
I can see all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But when I squint, I don't see as many wrinkles, so it allows you to simplify that version. I think also turning upside down kind of does the same thing,
mm-hmm.
Where it simplifies the imagery. And it also allows you to be in a state of feeling mm-hmm. A little bit more authentically without having to do what I call like noodling, where you get to a point of just, oh, I'm trying to paint this eyeball. And, I'm so focused on, the retina and the iris, and this has to be accurate, and this has to be this. And maybe not so much for an eyeball because it's circular, but when it's upside down, you're not looking at the image almost for what it is. You're just looking at the value, and mm-hmm. you can have a little bit more of creative interpretation between those values, which lends, I feel, to a more interesting image. I think sometimes when people look at images and, it's hard to tell sometimes what's considered a good visual image versus a bad visual image.
Right.
I always think that it's just hesitation.
Mm-hmm.
And that hesitation, I find, comes, for me at least, when I'm just trying to overthink what I'm painting or drawing.
Sure.
Because I'm trying to do all the details way too soon. And it's just, I don't know, our eyes are, as humans, are very sophisticated.
Right.
So you can tell, I guess it's almost like when you're listening to someone sing almost, right? Like, or playing an instrument where you can almost tell the difference between someone, I don't know, maybe you can tell me better, but like someone who can play, let's say the piano, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they know how to play the piano. Jazz, right? Whereas like you know the basics of it so well to where you can kind of get a little freer.
Sure.
And it still sound well. As opposed to someone who doesn't have those mechanics so well down and try to be a little bit more loose and free, and it can kind of sound a little.
Yeah, the technique or the facilities.
Yeah,
not
you can
there,
hear the technique, although they're kind of playing around. It's the same thing visually where it's like you can, the technique, if you're well in your season, the technique will still be there, mm-hmm. If you're still.
It's interesting because I hadn't really thought about it until this conversation, but the idea of turning the painting upside down,
mm-hmm.
there's a thing in music when I was studying composition.
Uh-huh.
where you're taught, let's say you write a melody. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine that melody written on the page. So that melody has a shape to it, you know, mm-hmm. low going high, et cetera, et cetera. But then there's a technique called inversion where you take that melody and you turn it upside down. Yeah. This is all in an effort to like create new content, but it's organic because it's coming from the original idea.
Yes.
So you can turn it upside down and start sparking new ideas. You can also, there's a thing called retrograde inversion where you have the idea upside down now, but you do it backwards.
Yeah.
But it's all, but the beauty of this is, and I'm kind of seeing how it might be related to visual art, it's all organic.
Yeah.
You're not creating anything new necessarily. You're just twisting it and morphing it into something else.
And yeah, it's the same thing, right? Because obviously there's composition in visual art also. And, you know, being able to compose your image is similar in that same mm-hmm. thing, right? Where it's like when I'm looking at my values, I'm painting and I'm creating my values as I go. And so there are points in my composition that I know, okay, this is going to be a little bit higher and this is going to be a little bit more bassy, I guess, like mm-hmm. in your darker tones. And you have to balance those in a way, or not balance them, but there is a method to that madness. It's not just throwing the paint on it. The composition does come into play there too. So there is a lot of similarities between, I mean, I listen to music a lot, and I can see colors when I hear like certain songs. Like I'll play certain playlists to evoke certain imagery and evoke right. certain colors and
right.
certain feelings. Mm-hmm. And I try to just translate that a lot of times to just what I'm painting, mm-hmm. you know, especially if, I mean, most of the time I know what I'm painting ahead of time, right? Like I know I'm about to paint a, you know, a person, you know, holding a goat. Right. So if I know that ahead of time, I'm like, all right, let me play a little bit of, I don't know.
What music goes with that?
That's, and then, okay, so for me, with music, I'm listening to a lot of this artist called St. John. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that because I'm in the mood of painting someone holding a goat and this song called Guyanese Mosh Pit.
Okay.
And it's like the image itself is a man holding a goat, but he's surrounded by like an endless crowd.
Okay.
And so I'm trying to create this chaos with this, you know, kind of solemn figure in the middle of it. And so, but that song has a lot of like, I mean, it's basically like punk rock almost. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of all over the place, but it's those tones that it starts with are very like, I guess low in register. Is that the best way? I don't know how to explain
sure. yeah,
the music.
Lower pitches. Mm-hmm.
So those colors to me, and I think a lot of times that's where those rustier colors come from, that iron, that right. grayish, mm-hmm. and the texture also of that is kind of like,
sure.
like really early right. on mm-hmm. in the song. So that part is where I really start with like a lot of my textures. And I start there.
Right.
And then pulling from that darkness more so, there's like little high points in the song, right? Where he goes kind of high up because he sings, even mm-hmm. though the beat on the song is very mosh pit, rockish, he's right. like singing very softly across the song. And those little high points when he's singing kind of mirror some of the like glares of like I'm having like spotlights come in on the crowd in certain points, and that's kind of where I'm thinking those colors kind of come in there.
Interesting.
So like my mind's kind of just flowing around that a little bit.
Right. Now I'm curious, just we're talking about composition, mm-hmm. visual art. I know for me as a musician and having written music for different things, mm-hmm. if I'm writing for myself, it could take forever. One thing I've always enjoyed about writing for clients, mm-hmm. Whether it be a film or something, I might not say it during the process, but I really do like a deadline.
Yes.
Now, you know, when you're in the process and you have a deadline, it's ominous a lot of times, and it's an irritant. But
yeah.
but knowing you have to have it done at a certain time, so how does that work with you? Do you feel the same way?
Even with my personal work, I've been trying to not so be so hard on myself with deadlines with my original work, but I do like to have a deadline overall,
right.
Mainly for that hesitation factor. I feel like if I'm just sitting, I should say this. So with my process, I start a lot of that off with writing. So there is a part of that I don't give myself a deadline with, right? Which is I'm writing about the concept. I'm composing the image itself. Where are the eyes going to be on this image? Where are the hands going to be situated?
You're writing words on a page?
Oh, yeah, I'm writing words on a page. Oh, okay. And those words, for instance, the one I'm talking about with the man with the goat, the words across the canvas are, you know, at the mercy of the state. And this one in particular is about our environments and how we create poverty and how poverty creates criminality and how we create criminality and how we create quote unquote good thieves. It's around all of that, right?
Right.
So I start with the writing process of it. And then after the writing process, then I take those words and I place them, I literally write them on the canvas and kind of just give it like a spirit. I may write it sparingly, I might write it, you know, directly. But once I start writing it on the canvas, that's when I tell myself, all right, I need to complete this canvas by X date. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I can sit with it for 2 years if I really wanted to, right? Like just like with any piece of art, like you can take it, break it down, redo it, take it, break it down, redo it, add to it. You can do that forever. But for me, and just the way my anxiety works, I know if I don't like just walk away from this image, I'm going to sit there with it for too long. And
oh, I see.
There's more, obviously it can grow, right? But I think I do love the time stamp of the image, right? Where it's just like I created this during this time period and then I walked away from it. So I would say for me personally, I do give myself deadlines. I've been trying to be a little bit more loose with the original work, but for clients, for sure. Yeah, I always give them deadlines. I do a lot of weddings. Mm. And with the weddings especially, we have our meetings prior to the wedding. And I give them an expectation of, hey, you know, this is what's going to happen the day of.
Right.
And then post the wedding, I usually give them like 3 months. And with commissions, like someone that just wants me to create something original but for them, I do the same thing. I give them a deadline. But the funnier thing I do with those that I've had to kind of just embrace, that's just how I work. Mm-hmm. I'll do that same process that I do in my original work where I write and I sit with it. And I have a deadline now, right? Like I have a hard deadline. And a lot of times I wait until like literally like the last minute before I start actually drawing and painting. And I find my best work comes from that, as opposed to what I used to do some years ago was I would, as soon as I get the, you know, the client and I give them like, you know, 6 months or however long it's going to take the, to create the painting, I just try to start immediately. Start. And then I'll do that process of like, well, now I'm kind of meandering with this work and I'm second guessing and I'm wanting to change this. And I find my work just wasn't as pure. So I was just relaxing more, thinking about it more, sleeping on it more, looking at just the blank canvas itself and just imagining myself painting it, dreaming about painting it, so that when I actually paint it, I'm just doing it. And then now with those raw emotions and those raw strokes, I'm not noodling, I'm not painting over other strokes. I'm kind of just putting it where it needs to go.
Right.
And it kind of just happens. And then I just get it out with the studio.
Hmm. There's some, for me, right, like with writing music, there's a similarity in that I know it works better for me. And it's kind of the same thing. When I was younger, I would do the same thing, like jump right into it, whatever it was I was doing. As I've gotten older, at least have some sort of preconceived blueprint.
Yes.
But understanding that that blueprint can change, just having some sort of structure to work with really helps.
Yeah, I've been telling a lot of younger artists this too, like because it is you get these, especially as artists, right, creatives, you walk down the street and everything is inspiring or so much can be inspiring to you. You hear a song, you know, you talk to someone, you know, you smell, you eat something, and you get inspired, and the first thing you do is create. I've learned to just write those things down, take a beat even sometimes, think about it and then try to form, like you said, like a blueprint or compose it a little bit before I just jump into it. Because I would say there are times where that hits, right? Where it's like you're in the moment, you get inspired, you put something together, and it's like, oh, I can't believe I just did that out of the blue. But I would say 9 times out of 10, you look back at that a year later and you go, I was just kind of in the moment. I don't know what I was doing. Right. I probably should have did this. I probably should have changed that. Mm. And I found just even taking sometimes a week to just step back with my work sometimes and just think about what inspired me, write it down. If I keep coming back to it, especially, and adding more to a concept and adding more, and then after, like, you know, some of these paintings in there, I've been writing on it maybe for about a couple years. And then once I'm like, okay, this just has to be painted now, then I just go to paint it.
Right.
Because it's like, it's all fleshed out. It makes sense. There's, I'm not going to say there's not a better way. They, like you said, as I'm going along in the painting process, sometimes things do change, right? Like, oh, this background, I was going to do a sunrise. Well, now I want to do a, you know, a storm now.
Right.
Because the way I was feeling originally was a little bit more positive in this part of the image, but maybe it's a little bit more tension as time went on, or as the painting process went on.
Right.
So I may change little things like that, or maybe even the level of detail, you know, that I may add. I may want to add a little more detail in this part of it just because of how I'm feeling now, or less, because, you know, I've grown to do that too, where I found that certain parts of the image, less definitely is more, because it brings focus to other parts.
Right.
And learning how to do that and it not take away from the image. Because it's easy to add less attention, quote unquote, or less detail to a certain part of an image to where it's glaring, where it's like, what is going on over here? And you're pulling focus away from where you want people to look, especially if it's somewhere to the edges of an image. Now, If their audience's eyes are going towards the edges too much, they're going to get disinterested sooner. So the more you can keep them, their eyes pulling back towards the center of an image, the more they stay and they look.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, you know, even like this image here, like it's composed on this wall here to keep you where that orange, red, and yellow squares are, even with those subtle lines that are kind of bordering it.
Right, but there's a focus.
There's a focus there. And it's simple, but it's composed well to keep you staring at it.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Do you experience this, you know, when you look back at work you did, you know, in the past, 5 years ago, 8 years ago, whatever. I know this with music, when I listen to recordings of myself, for the most part, honestly, most of the time, I'm like, oh, my gosh, you know. But it's interesting how that work of art represents where you were at that time. So it could be good and bad, because sometimes I'll listen to things and I'm like, it's interesting that I don't think that way anymore.
Yes.
Especially if I'm improvising something. Yes. I would never do that now. I'm not saying whether it's good or bad. It's just like, that's interesting, because it shows growth.
It's so, yeah, definitely do that. That, and I think sometimes that's what stifles people, right? It's like, I want this to be the best thing, so when I look back at it, I don't want to be ashamed of it. But, yeah, I definitely have looked at some stuff in the past. And what has helped me is getting better with composition, because I know if like the base composition of my image was well thought out, how I did the rest, I may critique some and may go, I don't like the way I did that part of it, or, but it does, that's been helping me with going back as of late. But yeah, there is something. I looked at an image I made in seventh grade, because I lost like almost all my art during Katrina.
Oh,
yeah. So it feels like I didn't even exist pre-Katrina. Like, art, clothes, like, I didn't have anything. So it's like school grades and stuff like that. Like, so all that was just gone. So I felt like my identity was just like this weird, like, ghost. But I found recently, like, this centurion that I drew. I went to a school and our mascot was the Centurions. Mm-hmm. And I looked at it and I was like, man, like, I don't know. I was just looking. I was like, oh, I always did. Like, that was like a self-doubt I had for a while, mm-hmm. where it's like I couldn't look at my childhood work with mm-hmm. like a, because I remember the things I drew. I remember the things I wrote, but not having it tangibly in front of me in any way is just like it. As time goes on, it's like, yeah, I remember drawing Lee when I was six in my mom's break room, and I can remember it vividly, but I bet if I looked at it like tangibly, mm-hmm. it's probably a little bit different from what I remember. So looking at that, it gave me that, you know, brief reminder of, oh, you know, you always did have a little bit of talent. It's not just something that just blossomed out of nowhere. Because it feels like that after Katrina, it was like, oh, this guy blossomed eventually, because you start to, you know, it's that pivot point. That was my senior year in high school too. So it's a big pivot point for me of who I was creatively before and who I was creatively afterwards. Yeah. And trying to like marry those two things and be a person at 37 years old.
Well, we've been talking a lot about, you know, your work as a freelance artist. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've noticed that's happened since I've gotten to know you in the past 2 years is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think starting about 2 years ago, you got more involved with, through the Arts Council, more administrative work.
Yes.
I know you were very involved, kind of carried most of the load for an initiative we did. We're part of a national initiative called Arts for Everybody.
Yes, yes.
In addition to that, like I mentioned when we started, you know, you're handling the gallery here as well as, you know, you do educational things as well. But talk to me about, you know, your development and growth as an administrator and things you like about that and maybe things you don't.
I mean, I could start with the things I don't. Those are easy. Those are always easy. I'm just not a big, I don't know, I feel like I'm very self-conscious about communication and making sure people understand.
Sure.
So when it comes to like, you know, like emails, it's always like, mm-hmm. I don't know. I just feel like I overthink emails, which takes me longer to send emails. So that's like literally the one administrative thing, is just emails. I'm just not a big email person. Right. Outside of that though, to be honest, I would say first off, my wife definitely is a big help for me. Mm-hmm. Just running the business as a individual artist has always been a big help, and that helped with the administrative parts of mm-hmm. Of the arts, and just understanding that I can't just approach this industry I can approach the industry just loosely and not have any tact when it comes to organizations, mm-hmm. The community, other people that I work with, and understanding how to interact with folks when it comes to anything outside of me creating a piece.
Right.
Right. And I've always, you know, I remember just as long as I've always told myself and told my grandma, you know, to which she didn't like too much, you know, I don't know if I believe in God too much, but I definitely believe in people, and I love humanity so much. So when it came to what I love the most about the administrative parts of the arts is being able to connect with all the different facets of our mm-hmm. community. Education is a big one. For me growing up, if I didn't have like older artists not necessarily telling me, hey, do these things and you'll become a successful artist, but just being themselves authentically mm-hmm. in New Orleans and just it being so normalized, in hindsight, I've realized, oh, those things help. Like just seeing, I don't know, something as authentic as like Cash Money, you know, like mm-hmm. the rappers and stuff like that, right? Like seeing them just existing in our neighborhoods allowed for us to just be our authentic selves. And I find me being my authentic self when we're in schools, while also teaching them the skills that they need to learn, mm-hmm. but just letting them know, like, hey, these skills that you're learning, I know maybe most teachers or most schools or just society in general is going to tell you that these things are just kind of just these little fun things you learn. The arts are very important. Here's why. Like, here's my story.
Right.
And I don't know. It's just being able to really connect in all those different ways, whether it be through the schools, mm-hmm. Whether it be through the gallery with other artists, or even just being here at the Arts Council and just being able to walk in and invite people into the doors and say, hey, what are you working on? Or how do you feel right now? Or do you just need a space to just get away,
right,
and just not be outside for a second and just mm-hmm. be in the gallery and taking in art? There's just something very cathartic about that.
Mm-hmm.
Where I don't have to, I find it daunting sometimes where people come into the Arts Council and they come to the studio where I'm at and we stand there and talk about my art all the time. And the whole time I'm like, man, there's so much in this building, there's so much in this city that is just as talented and even more talented that, you know, that you can learn about. So I find it very moving to get out of my studio and get into the other parts and, you
right.
know, get people excited about those things.
Have you come across this aspect of it? I know I have.
Mm-hmm.
When you're dealing with, as an some sort of administrative capacity, and you're dealing with artists, fellow artists, sometimes the challenge that I found is, you know, you're dealing with creative people, which I love. That's an energy yeah. and an inspiration in itself. But sometimes just corralling that
yeah.
and just, you know, getting to what the focus is going to be. But, you know, what's the saying? Trying to herd cats sometimes. It's like, you know, the creativity is all over the place.
Yeah.
And managing people, I don't like to say it that way, but it ultimately does sort of become that.
It becomes that. What I've learned in these couple years of being in that realm is meeting people where they are.
Right.
And listening to people, because I've been that artist where I'll walk into a building organization, maybe not saying things clearly, maybe stumbling over my words, maybe not being clear about what I want out of being an artist, creatively all over the place, you know, which most of us kind of are for the most part.
Right.
It's understanding where they are as a person. It's just, all right, where are you? Like, do you live in the city? What part of the city do you live in? Where do you work? Do you work?
Mm-hmm.
Do you need work?
Right.
Or do you need money? Most of them need money.
Sure.
All right, cool. And when you start breaking down those barriers, I think it starts to just become a conversation from person to person. And then they eventually, I find, tend to lean heavily on, all right, here's what I want. Here's what I'm more passionate about. And it's easier to kind of, you know, lead them in the best directions without, or just tell them, hey, look, just work on these things over here and maybe, you know, come back to this part of the process. Like, you know, with the gallery, for instance, we get a lot of people that just walk in and say, hey, I want to do a show.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, okay, cool. You know, tell me about yourself. You know, how much, you know, what do you have as far as your work, like your portfolio? I don't really have a portfolio. I got like, you know, a couple pieces. Cool. Show me the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd like to see at least 20 to 30 pieces. So
right.
How long would that take you to create 20 good, you know, 30, 20 or 30, you know, really good pieces.
Right.
And then that reality sometimes sets in there, right, with that situation of, oh, I need 20 or 30 pieces. Cool. And then we can help build you to that point.
Right.
I'm working with an artist right now who wants to do a show and has been calling me maybe every day of like, I want to do a show. I just need to teach me how to do that. Like, you know, like no one teaches.
Right. So you're really functioning as an educator.
Yeah. As an educator, because right. There's no right way to do any of the things that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The arts are so broad, and especially with visual arts, I feel like there's a way that galleries and institutions have told artists that they should function.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Was like, oh, you should be in a gallery. You should have gallery shows, and your gallery show should look like this. And they should, your labels should look like this, and your pricing should be this.
Try to codify everything.
Try to codify everything. And that's like the worst thing for an artist, if like, mm-hmm. they just want to create the things. Right. And it's just understanding where your strengths are as an artist. And because I know for me, like the way I run my original artwork, it's all based off just everything I'm comfortable with. Mm-hmm. You know, like I don't really stray too far outside of that. And I just kind of, and people know that when I come to the table of like, hey, we want to do a show with you and we know all of your art is freaking huge. So we only need like 6 paintings to fill up this entire room. Cool. Right. I don't have to create 40 new smaller paintings. You know that I'm not going to do that. Like, you know I'm not going to do that.
Right, right.
So just understanding where you are, what you want to be, and I mean, shoot, getting them to, when they're creative all over the place, like getting them to just understand that if they are creatively all over the place, to live in that for a little bit, because sometimes you have to be all over the place.
Right.
And I like to try to help people. I think the most valuable thing that I really bring for a lot of artists is helping them find their voice.
Sure.
Because when you're creative, you're all over the place. That means you're not sure how to communicate, right? It's like someone who's stammering, maybe, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I see when I see someone who's creatively all over the place. Like, they're trying to communicate, but there's gaps in the communication here and there. So the person, your audience, is trying to figure out what you're trying to communicate, and it's taking them a bit longer to try to figure that out.
Right.
So if I can help with that impediment, that artistic impediment, and get you to just communicate what you want to put on your canvas, whatever that is, then once you're authentically just creating that, people buy that. People will come for that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to paint like Basquiat. You don't have to paint like Terrence Osborne in order to sell your artwork. Paint like yourself.
Right.
And people pay for your story. They don't pay for the most skilled person in the room. They pay for the person who's the most authentic and can tell a good story. Right. At least visually. I don't
know. No, the same thing exists in music. And I, you know, it's interesting. Miles Davis had a saying of, you know, for some people, it takes years to find their, in the music sense, their sound, their voice, if you will. Some people, it comes quicker, but there's a process, I know, in music of, especially when I used to teach more, where I would tell the students when they're trying to learn improvisation, you know, go listen to so-and-so, and go listen to so-and-so, and listen to lots of people, but realize there's a, because you're you, there's a filter that needs to happen. Don't be overly influenced by someone, but take the things that you like about so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, and it's going to go through that funnel, that filter, and over time, takes time, so enjoy the process. You do find your voice, you know, you might not even realize it, but you start to do things that resonate with you.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, same thing in visual, where I try to say the same thing, look through art as much as you can, go to galleries, which is something that I try to do at least once a quarter, like travel and go somewhere else and go to a gallery. But I tell artists, like, the best thing you're going to be able to do is look at other people's art, even if it's on your phone and scrolling, like just visually seeing what people are doing. And yeah, that filter where it's like, oh, I like the way they did this, and be critical, like, you know, be overly critical of everything that you're looking at. And that's that filter working of, oh, I don't like the way they did that. Fine. How would you have done that differently?
Right.
You know, and as you're working through that filter, also at the same time, when you go back to create your work, I like to tell people to ask themselves, what's the story of your life? And start there and be truthful about it. Don't make something up. And that can be hard for a lot of people, right? Because the story of your life, you know, can be traumatic. And I'm be honest, shoot, for most of us, I think it is kind of traumatic. I mean, that's kind of how humans grow. Like, we go through these different traumas and we learn from them.
Sure.
So you go back to, what's the story of my life? A lot of times you go back to your childhood. And then when you kind of start creating from that point, you're going through the filter of all the things you're bringing in, what you like, you don't like. All right, cool. Now, what's my life about? And then you start creating from that.
Right.
It gets, your voice starts to shine.
Right.
You know.
Well, so what's coming up? What are you excited about? Maybe, you know, let's start with a plug for the Arts Council. So what do you have, what's in the gallery and what's coming up there?
So at the gallery, we have the Big Buddy program. They're going to be doing their showcase. It's about 100 students, and I want to say 6 or 7 teachers working through Big Buddy, teaching artists. We're going to have that through the gallery through July 17th through the end of, I'm sorry, July 17th through August 4th.
Okay.
And then right after that, we're going to have some LSU and Tulane grad students. They're going to have their work up for a few weeks. They have to do their thesis, so they're going to be learning how to put their art in a gallery, curate it themselves.
Right.
And so that's going to be showing for a few weeks in August. And then September, we're going to be looking forward to our Southern University faculty show, which is going to be really good. Some of my favorite artists in Baton Rouge are Southern's faculty.
Right.
And I say that again to point out that Southern does not or no longer has an art program. An art major. So that's really important. That's a really big one for me this year to highlight, because we want to try to get Southern's accreditation back for the university, for the arts major. Too many good artists have come out of Southern and for them not to have an art major. It's, I mean, we have Frank Hayden's work everywhere.
Right.
Quite literally everywhere across the country.
Right.
And so... That's the big thing happening in the Shell Gallery. Me myself, I'm working on a series right now called Electric Blue. Personally, it's going to be about 20 paintings. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 other mediums of artists that I'm working with, hopefully in the same vein of Electric Blue. I'm not going to say too much about it. It's going to be something that we're just going to work on and just kind of put out there. And that's going to be next year. So just keep your eyes and your ears and all your other senses open for that.
Well, that brings up the next question. Mm-hmm. So if people want to follow you and learn more about Mike Weary, how do they find you?
I think the best place is follow me on Instagram. That's where I'm the most active. That's where you can see the most images and hear my lovely voice the most. It's at Mike Weary Art. Okay. And that's actually across all social media platforms. That's at Mike Weary Art on Facebook. At Mike Weary Art, I'm on TikTok. I don't post much, but if you just want to send me some stuff there, go for it. But and also MikeWearyArt.com if you'd like to purchase or inquire about commissions, weddings, anything like that, events, corporate events, MikeWearyArt.com.
Awesome. Well, Mike, I appreciate you joining me. It's been a great conversation. It's always great to talk to you and
same with
inspiring,
you, Mike.
You know. So thanks again, and man, wishing you all the best.
Wishing you the best too. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
The Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge would like to acknowledge our generous sponsors, the Shell Corporation, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Louisiana Office of Cultural Development, and the City of Baton Rouge.